This is disc number 9.
Please, the girl said. Kaylin crossed her lips with a finger, lest the sisters hear the girl. Just like the man back at the inn, this girl saw and remembered Kaylin. Kaylin was astonished, and at the same time fearful that the same thing would happen to the girl as had happened to the man. Please, the girl repeated in a low whisper, may I have something to eat? I'm so hungry. Kaylin glanced at the sisters. They were busy talking among themselves. Kaylin reached into her saddlebag in the pile near her feet and pulled out a strip of dried venison. She again crossed her lips with one finger and handed the girl the meat. The girl nodded her understanding and didn't make a sound. Taking the meat eagerly in both hands, she immediately used her teeth to rip off a bite. Go now, Kaylin whispered, before they see you. Hurry! The girl glanced up at Kaylin, then looked past her. Her eyes went wide. Her chewing halted. Well, well, came a menacing voice over Kaylin's shoulder. If it isn't our little mule come to steal from us. Please, she was hungry, Kaylin said, hoping to douse Sister Alicia's anger before it flared. She asked for a bite to eat. She didn't steal it. I gave her my food, not any of yours. Sister Alicia was joined by the other two, so that it looked like three vultures all in a row. Sister Armina lifted the lantern to have a better look. All three looked like they intended to pick the girl's bones clean. Probably waiting till we went to sleep, Sister Alicia said as she leaned closer, so she could cut our throats. Copper-colored eyes shone in the lamplight as the frightened young woman gazed up at them. I wasn't lying in wait. I was hungry. I thought I might be able to get a little food. That's all. I asked. I did not steal. The young woman reminded Kaylin a little of the girl back at the White Horse Inn, the girl Kaylin had promised to protect, the girl that Sister Alicia had so brutally murdered. At night, before she fell asleep, the memory of that girl's terror still haunted Kaylin. Her failure to keep her promise of protection still burned in Kaylin's soul. Even if the girl hadn't been able to remember Kaylin's words long enough to comprehend them, Kaylin hated that she had made such a promise and then failed to keep it. This girl was a little older, a little taller. Kaylin could see in her eyes, too, a kind of quiet comprehension of the true dimension of the threat before her. There was a kind of knowing caution in her copper eyes, but she was still a girl. Womanhood was still a mystery that lay just over her life's horizon. Sister Armina suddenly smacked the girl. The blow spun her around, knocking her to the ground. The sister pounced on her. The girl covered her head with her arms as she tried her best to get out an apology for asking for food. Sister Armina pawed at the girl's clothes between striking her. When the sister rose, she held a knife that Kaylin didn't recognize. She waggled it in the lantern light, then tossed it to the ground at Sister Alicia's feet. She was carrying this. Like you said, she probably intended to cut our throats after we'd gone to sleep. I intended no harm, the girl cried out as Sister Alicia raised her oak rod. Kaylin knew all too well what was coming and dove over the frightened girl, covering her, protecting her. Sister Alicia's rod came crashing down across Kaylin's back instead, right over the spot where she had been hit earlier. The girl flinched at the crack of oak against bone. Kaylin cried out with the pain of the blow. With all her effort, she pushed the young woman farther away from the sisters, trying to keep her protected from harm. Leave her be, Kaylin yelled. She's just a child. She's hungry, that's all. She can't hurt any of you. In the grip of panic, the girl's spindly arms clung to Kaylin's neck, as if it were the lone root hanging at the edge of a cliff. If Kaylin could have killed the sisters right then, she would have. But instead she did no more than protectively shield the girl. She knew that if she tried to fight them, the sisters would pull her away for retaliation, and then she could be no protection at all. This was the most Kaylin could do for the girl. Again, Sister Alicia struck Kaylin across the back. Kaylin gritted her teeth against the pain. Again and again the woman landed blows with the rod. Let the brat go! Sister Alicia yelled as she beat Kaylin. The girl panted in terror. It's all right, Kaelin managed between gasps for breath. I'll protect you. I promise. The young woman whispered back a thank you in Kaelin's ear. Besides her desperate desire to protect such an innocent child, Kaelin desperately didn't want to lose this connection to the world. The girl knew that Kaelin existed. She could see her, hear her, remember her. Kaelin needed that lifeline back to the world of people. Sister Ulysia took a stride closer as she swung away at Kaelin, putting all her muscle into the beating. Kaelin knew she was in grievous trouble, but she was not going to willingly allow them to harm this girl as they had the last one. The girl had done nothing to deserve what Kaelin knew they would do to her. "How dare you! If you wish to kill someone," Kaelin yelled up at Sister Ulysia, "then kill me, but leave her be! She's no threat to you!" Sister Ulysia seemed content to do just that, growling with the effort of clubbing Kaelin, striking over and over again in a frenzy. Kaelin was getting dizzy with the pain, but she would not move to allow the sister to get at the girl. The young woman hid under the protection of Kaelin's larger frame, crying out with fright, not at what the sisters might do to her, but in anguish for what they were doing to Kaelin. The rod made a sickening sound as it struck the back of Kaelin's skull. It stunned her nearly senseless. Still, she would not let go of the young woman. Blood matted her hair and ran down her face. And then the rod broke against Kaelin's back. The larger piece spun out into the night. Sister Ulysia stood panting, in a blind rage, holding a useless stub. Kaelin expected to be killed, but in a way she no longer cared. There was no possibility of escape. There was no future for her. If she couldn't fight for the life of an innocent young woman, then life was of no value to her.
"Ulysia," Armina whispered as she caught Ulysia's wrist. "She sees Kaelin, just like that man at the inn."
Sister Ulysia stared at her companion, seemingly startled by the idea. Sister Armina lifted an eyebrow.
"We need to find out what's going on."
Sister Cecilia, a sinister glare twisting her features, not having heard what Sister Armina had said, stepped closer and stood over Kaelin. "How dare you defy a sister? We're going to skin this brat alive and make you watch the whole thing to teach you a lesson."
"Sister," the girl asked, "are you all sisters?" The night suddenly seemed impossibly quiet.
Kaelin's world spun sickeningly. Each breath felt like knives twisting between her ribs. Tears from the pain of the blows ran down her face. She couldn't stop trembling, but still she would not abandon the girl. Sister Ulysia tossed the end of the broken oak rod aside. "We are sisters, what of it?" she asked suspiciously.
"Tovi told me to watch for you, although you don't look to me much like Tovi's sisters."
Everyone paused.
"Tovi?"
Sister Ulysia cautiously asked. The girl nodded. She peeked out past Kaelin's shoulder. "She's an older woman. She's big, bigger than any of you, and she doesn't really look like your sister, but she told me to go out and watch for her sisters. She said that the three of you had another woman with you." "And why would a girl like you agree to do as Tovi asked?" The girl brushed her dark hair back from her face. She hesitated, then answered, "She is holding my grandfather captive. She said that if I didn't do as she said, then she would kill him." Ulysia smiled the way Kaelin imagined a snake would smile, if a snake could smile. "Well, well, I guess you really do know Tovi. Where is she, then?" Kaelin pushed herself up on an arm. The girl pointed toward the headland. "There. She is in a place with old books. She made me show her where the books were kept. She told me to guide you to her." Sister Ulysia shared a look with the other two. Perhaps she's already located the central site in Casca. Sister Armina cackled with relief as she jovially clapped Sister Cecilia on the back of the shoulder. Sister Cecilia returned the gesture in kind.
"How far is it?"
Sister Ulysia asked, suddenly eager. "It will take all of 2 days, maybe three, if we leave at first light in the morning." Sister Ulysia peered off into the darkness for a moment.
2 or 3 days.
She turned back. What's your name?
Jillian.
Sister Alicia kicked Kaelin in the side, the unexpected blow rolling her off the girl. Well, Jillian, you can have Kaelin's bedroll. She won't be needing it. She's going to stand for the night as punishment.
Please,
Jillian said as she laid a hand on Kaelin's arm. If not for her, you would now be without a guide to the place where Tovi is. Please don't punish her. She did you a favor. Sister Alicia considered a moment. I'll tell you what, Jillian. Since you spoke up for our disobedient slave, I'll let you make sure that she doesn't sit down during the night. If she does disobey us, I will give her a beating that will leave her with a painful limp for the rest of her life. But you can prevent that by making sure she stands the entire night. What do you think of that?
Jillian swallowed, but didn't answer.
Sister Alicia snatched Kaelin by the hair and hauled her to her feet. Make sure she stays on her feet, or what we do to her will be your fault for not making sure that she did as she was told. Understand?
Jillian, her copper-colored eyes wide, nodded.
Sister Alicia smiled a sly smile. Good. She turned to the other two. Come on, let's get some sleep.
After they had gone, Kaelin gently laid a hand on the top of the head of the girl sitting at her feet.
Glad to meet you, Jillian, Kaelin whispered so that the sisters wouldn't hear.
Jillian smiled up at her and whispered, Thank you for protecting me. Your promise was true. She gently took Kaelin's hand and held it to her cheek for a moment. You are the bravest person I've seen since Richard.
Richard?
Richard Rawl. He was here before. He saved my grandfather before. But now...
Jillian's voice trailed off as she looked away from Kaelin's gaze. Kaelin gently stroked the girl's head, hoping to comfort her heartache for her grandfather. She gestured, pointing with her chin.
Go in that saddlebag there, Jillian, and get yourself something to eat. She was trembling from the pain, and wanted very much to lie down. But Kaelin knew that Sister Alicia had not made an empty threat.
Then if you would, please, just sit with me for the night. I could use a friend tonight.
Jillian smiled up at her. It warmed Kaelin's heart to see such a sincere smile.
In the morning you will have another friend to join us.
When Kaelin twitched a frown, Jillian pointed up at the sky. I have a raven named Loki. In the day he will come and entertain us with some of his tricks.
Kaelin smiled at the very idea of having a raven for a friend.
The girl squeezed Kaelin's hand. I won't leave you tonight, Kaelin. I promise.
As much agony as she was in, as bleak as her future seemed, Kaelin was joyous. Jillian was alive. Kaelin had just won her first battle, and that accomplishment was exhilarating.
Chapter 24. As he walked among the gathered soldiers, Richard acknowledged their greetings with a smile and a nod. He was in no mood to smile, but he feared that the men would misunderstand it if he didn't. Their eyes were filled with expectation and hope as they watched him make his way among them. Many a man stood silently with a fist over his heart, not just in salute, but in pride. Richard could not begin to explain to each of these men the horrific things Shota had shown him. And so he smiled as warmly as he was able. Beyond the encampment, lightning flickered at the horizon. Even over the sounds of camp life, the thousands of men and horses, of the ring of blacksmiths' hammers, the unloading of supplies, the provisions being distributed, the orders being shouted, Richard could hear the lightning's ominous rumble rolling along the Azrith Plain. Angry thunderclouds gathered an ever-growing charge of black shadows under their skirts. The still, humid air was occasionally aroused by gusts that lifted flags and pennants to flapping attention. Almost as soon as it arrived, the wind would suddenly vanish, like an advance guard racing back to report to the gathering storm. No one seemed to care about the threatening sky, though.
They all wanted to get a glimpse of Richard as he made his way through the encampment. There was a time when this very army was bound and determined to kill or capture him. But that was before Richard had become the Lord Rawl. Once he had taken on that responsibility, he had given these men the chance to stand for a worthy cause, rather than carry arms in service to tyranny. There had been some who had viewed that offer with open hatred. They turned instead to the cause of the Order, and swept across the land with blind brutality, seeking to exterminate the very idea that any man had a right to his own life. But the rest of them, most of them in fact, had not just taken up Richard's challenge. They had embraced it with a kind of fervor that only men who had lived under repression could. These men, the first in generations to be offered real freedom, truly grasped its meaning for their lives. They held on tenaciously to the chance to live in the kind of world Richard had shown them was possible. There was no greater nor more meaningful a gift these men could in turn give their families and loved ones than that chance to live life free, to live for themselves. Many had died in that noble effort. Much the same as the moored Sith, these men followed him now because they chose to, not because they were forced to. When they called him Lord Rawl, it had meaning to them that it had never carried before. But these men now faced the edged steel that enforced a belief that said they and their loved ones had no right to their own lives. Richard did not doubt the hearts of these men, but he knew that they could not prevail in a battle against the vast numbers of Imperial Order invaders. This day of all days, he had to be the Lord Rawl. If there was to be a chance at a future worth living, Richard had to be the Lord Rawl in the purest sense, the Lord Rawl who cared about those he led. He had to make them see what he saw. Verna, hurrying along beside him, tightened her grip on his arm as she leaned a little closer. "You can't imagine how uplifting it is for these men to see you before the battle they will be facing, Richard. The battle that prophecy has been foretelling for thousands of years. You just can't imagine." Richard doubted that the men could imagine what he was about to ask of them. He glanced over at Verna's smile. "I know, prelate." Because they were steadily making headway south to meet the threat from the Imperial Order, the ride from the People's Palace to catch up with them had taken considerably longer than the last time he had come to see these soldiers. Once the Order turned north up into Dahara, this army was all that stood against them. These men were the last hope of the Daharan Empire. That was their calling, their duty. And Richard knew without doubt that they would lose that battle. Richard's task was to convince them of the certainty of their impending defeat and death. Kara and Nikki, right behind him, were practically walking on his heels. He didn't think they needed to be that close to protect him, but he also knew that neither woman would likely take his word for it. When he glanced back over his shoulder, Nikki gave him a tight smile. He wondered what she would say once she heard what he was about to tell the soldiers. He supposed that she would understand. Of all those who would hear what he had to say, she was the one person he believed would understand. In fact, he was counting on it. Her understanding and support were sometimes all that kept him going. There were times when he had been ready to give up, and Nikki had given him the strength to go on. Richard knew that Kara, on the other hand, would welcome what he was about to say, if for entirely different reasons. Although Kara looked as grim as ever, as if she might have to kill the entire army should they suddenly turn to treason and attack Richard, he could tell by the way her fingers worked at a seam of her red leather outfit that she was eager to at last see General Myford, Benjamin, again. Since the last time they had been with these men, she was a little less reticent about letting her feelings for the handsome Daharan general be known. Richard suspected that Nikki had something to do with that. As overwhelmed as he felt about a world that seemed to be coming down around him, he was inwardly gratified that a moored Sith could ever come to have such feelings, and even more so that she would finally be willing to let them be known, at least to him. It was confirmation that, beyond the brutal training of these women, they were individuals who each had long-suppressed desires and aspirations that had not withered and died, and that the true person inside could again blossom. It was an affirmation of his belief in a better future, that there could be a better future, like finding a beautiful flower in a vast wasteland. As Richard marched past rows of tents, wagons, picketed horses, blacksmith stations, and supply areas, he could see men approaching from all directions, abandoning their evening chores of caring for animals, repairing gear, tending to supplies, cooking, and setting up yet more tents. A glance to the thick overcast told him that they would be smart to at least finish setting up their tents. Richard spotted General Myford among the sea of men in dark uniforms. He stood tall among officers outside a large command area. When Richard glanced back over his shoulder, he could see by Kara's smile that she saw him as well. The assembled officers and men of rank were too many to fit into a tent, so they had gathered among a scattered boulder field. Awnings had been strung together over the area, anchored to the massive boulders, so that the men in the command center would be protected should the rain start. It didn't look to Richard like it would protect them from any wind, but it would at least keep them mostly dry as they worked on the details of directing an army this large. Richard leaned a little toward Verna as thunder shook the ground. "Your sisters will be there?" Verna nodded. "Yes, I sent runners to tell them that you wanted them there along with all the officers. There are a few on distant reconnaissance, but the rest will be there." "Lord Rawl!" General Myford said as he clapped a fist to his heart. Richard bowed his head. "General, glad to see you well. The men all look in order, as always." "Thank you, Lord Rawl." His blue eyes were already taking in Kara. He bowed at the waist to her. "Mistress Kara." Kara actually smiled. "You are a happy sight for my eyes, Benjamin." Had Richard not been so distressed about the things that had brought him to be there, he would have derived great pleasure from seeing them gaze into each other's eyes. Richard remembered looking at Kaelin that way, remembered his inner joy at seeing her. Captain Zimmer, his shaped leather armor serving to accentuate his powerful build, stood not far behind the general. Some of the other officers, in similar if less simple uniforms, waited in a cluster nearby, while most were already assembled under the awning. The groups of men, engaged in earnest conversation, all fell quiet and turned to see Lord Rawl, the leader of the Daharan Empire. Richard didn't have time for pleasantries, so he dove right in. Likewise, the regular soldiers who had gathered all around stood silently watching. "Are all the officers and men of rank here, General?" Richard asked. The man nodded. "Yes, Lord Rawl. Every one of them in camp, anyway. There are some out on long-range patrol. Had we known of your arrival and wishes, I would have recalled them, but as it is, we would need some time to get them back here. If you wish, I will send word at once for them to return." Richard lifted a hand to forestall the suggestion. "No, that's not necessary. As long as most of them are assembled, that will do. The rest can be briefed later." There were far too many men in the encampment for Richard to be heard and understood by them all. His intent was to speak in detail to the officers and men of rank, and then have them spread the word among their own men. There were enough officers gathered for that task. The general, in a casual but clearly commanding manner, gestured to the men surrounding the command area, watching the great event. They immediately began to disperse, going back to their own work, while their commanders learned of their fate. General Myford held out an arm, inviting Richard and his escort in under shelter. Richard first glanced at the sky, judging the chances to be good that the rain would soon start in earnest. In under the expansive tarp, hundreds of men were gathered tightly together. Richard tapped his fist to his heart, returning the collective muffled thump of their sharp salutes. "I am here today," Richard began as he scanned all the eyes watching him, "about the gravest of issues, the coming final battle with the advancing army of the Imperial Order. There must be no confusion about what I will have to say. I need every one of you to understand what is at stake, what I am going to ask of you, and why. This is about all of our lives. I will not hold back anything from you, and I will answer honestly and to the best of my ability anything you want to know. Please feel free to ask your questions, voice your objections, or even to disagree with certain points as I lay out what I've decided. I value your vast collective knowledge and skill. I trust in your ability and experience. But I have had to weigh and consider matters outside your purview, and on everything put together, I have made my decision. I can appreciate that, absent such information, you may not entirely understand my reasoning, so I will do my best to explain it. But there will be no dissent about my conclusion.
Richard's voice took on an edge of absolute resolve.
You will follow my orders.
The men all shared looks. This was as stern a command as any Richard had ever given them. In the afternoon hush, Richard began to slowly pace back and forth, choosing his words carefully. He finally gestured out to the crowd before him.
As officers, as men of command, what is it that preoccupies your minds the most?
After a moment's confused silence, an officer to the side spoke up.
I suppose that we're all thinking about what you've already mentioned, Lord Rawl. The final battle.
That's right. The final battle, Richard said as he came to a halt and turned to the men.
That's the common way we all think, that everything will come down to that defining moment, the climax of everyone's effort, and there will be a final grand battle to decide it all. Who wins, who loses, who rules, who serves, who lives, who dies. This is the way Jagang thinks as well.
He wouldn't be their leader if he didn't, an older officer said. Sporadic chuckles rippled through the assembled men.
True enough, Richard said in a solemn voice. Especially in the case of Emperor Jagang. His objective is to carry his cause to that final battle, and in that concluding contest crush us once and for all. He is a very intelligent foe. He has gotten us to focus on that final battle. His strategy is working.
The laughter had died out. The men looked a little displeased that Richard would give the man so much credit. Soldiers like these didn't like to grant their enemy too much mastery, lest their own men suffer a failing of courage at fighting him. Richard had no interest in making Jagang seem less of a threat than he was. Quite the opposite. He wanted to give these men an accurate glimpse of what they were up against, and the true dimensions of the menace.
Jagang is a devotee of a game called Jala de Jin.
Seeing some of the men nod, Richard knew that they had become at least somewhat familiar with the game.
He has his own Jala team, much like the Fellowship of Order has its own army. Jagang's overriding concern, when he sends his team into play, is to win at Jala. To that end, he collected the biggest, toughest players for his team. He does not view it as a contest, a competition, as some do. He intends not merely to be victorious in any Jala match, but to overwhelm the opposition. Jagang's team once lost. His solution was not to try harder the next time, to train and coach his players, to do better the next time. He instead went out and got other players. He created a team of the biggest, strongest, fastest men. The translation of Jala de Jin, by the way, is the game of life. In the beginning, when he was joining all the various kingdoms and lands of the old world into one nation, Jagang lost battles. He learned the lessons of life. He got the biggest, meanest army he could, and in the end he united the entire old world under the banner of the Order. When he embarked on this war, at the behest of the Fellowship of Order, Jagang made sure that he would have at his disposal the resources necessary to ensure that he would have a force large enough to do the job. You men would do no less. Jagang occasionally still lost battles. Again he learned. He responded by calling upon those resources to see to it that he had more men. That's how he approaches the goal of winning the war on behalf of the Order. The result is that today he has a force so overwhelming that he can crush all opposition. He knows that he will win, so he looks forward to the final battle. In addition, Emperor Jagang was a dreamwalker, a man with powers handed down to him through ancient magic. He used that ability to invade the minds of others not only to gain knowledge, but to control them. Today, as you know, he controls a number of gifted people, sisters of the light and the dark among them. He thus commands both forces of steel and magic. Lord Rawl, one of the older officers said, interrupting Richard's pacing speech, you dismiss our men too easily. Most of our army is made up of Daharan forces, and the rest we have trained. These men know what is at stake. They are not green recruits. They are experienced soldiers who know how to fight. We also have Verna and her sisters, who have proven themselves. Along with these skilled soldiers and sisters of the light, we have right on our side. The Imperial Order is not predestined to lose just because they are evil. In the long run, evil will turn in on itself. But for our lives and the lives of those we protect, that is little comfort. Evil can still dominate mankind for 1,000 years, 2,000, or even more before it eventually dies of its own poison. Richard started pacing again as he spoke with great passion. There are times in history when things might have gone either way, but for the valiant efforts of some individuals, I grant you. In fact, I am counting on it. This is the time when we decide what will be our future. This is the time when we must do what must be done, despite how painful it will be, if we and our children are to have a future. Our future, freedom's future, hinges on us and what we do, on whether or not we succeed. Lord Rawl, the older officer said with quiet assurance, the men know that our backs are to the wall. They will fight, if that's what you're suggesting. Richard realized that the men weren't understanding what he was getting at. He stopped and faced the men as he clasped his hands behind his back. In the back of his mind he could see the ghostly image that Shota had shown him of the bloody end of it all. It was like a weight trying to drag him under. Richard finally spoke. I've always said that I can't lead us into a final battle with the Order, or we would lose. Things have happened since last I was with you men that make me believe that now more than ever before. Rumblings of discontent matched the rumblings of thunder filling the gloomy afternoon air. Before they could object or take him off on a tangent, Richard went on. The army of the Order is very soon going to be advancing up into Dahara from the south on their way to the People's Palace. You men are advancing south to meet them. They know that. They expect that. They want that. We are marching to Jagang's orders. He is controlling our tactics. He is drawing us into a battle he knows we can't win and that he can't lose. Voices of protest erupted, all shouting that the future wasn't fixed, that they could prevail. Richard held up a hand to halt the voices. While the future isn't fixed, reality is what it is. As soldiers, you plan your tactics according to what you know, not what you wish. Even if by some miracle we were able to win this looming battle, it would turn out not to be decisive. Such a battle would end up merely being a fight we won at a great cost, while the Order would simply come right back at us again with an even larger force. Even if we were to win the impending battle, which I know we can't, we would then have to fight another battle against even more men and then another. Why? Because each time we fight them, we lose men and get weaker. We have little reserves to call upon. Each time Jagang needs them, he gets a steady stream of nearly limitless reinforcements and only gets stronger. We would lose in the end for one very simple reason. No war is ever won defensively. While a defensive battle can be won, a war cannot be won defensively. So, an officer asked, what do you propose? That we sue for peace? Richard dismissed the idea with a casual, if irritated, gesture. The Order would grant no peace terms. Maybe long ago, in the beginning, they would have accepted our surrender, allowed us to bow and kiss their boots, allowed us to put on the chains of slavery, but not now. Now they want only a victory bought and paid for with our blood. But what difference would it have made? Either way, the end result would be the same, the murder and subjugation of us and our people. How we lose, for the most part, is irrelevant. Surrender or defeat ends with the same result. One way or the other, all is lost. Then what? The man stammered in a heated voice. Fight on until we are finally killed or captured? The men stared at the red-faced officer who had spoken. These men had been fighting the Order for a long time. They were not hearing anything they didn't already know. Still, fighting the invaders was all they could do. It was their duty. It was the only thing they knew. Richard turned and took in Kara, standing there in her red leather, her feet spread, her hands clasped behind her back. She looked like she believed she could take on the Order all by herself. Richard gestured to the woman standing beside Kara. Nikki here once served on their side. When he heard the whispers about an enemy among them, he added, "Much the same as all of you were once in the service of tyranny when you served Darkon Rall. And some of you, even his father, Panis Rall. You had no choice. Darkon Rall did not care what you wanted to do with your lives. He only cared that you followed his orders. Now, when given a choice, you have committed to our cause. Nikki has as well. The men of the Order are different. You were fighting because you were made to, under threat of violence or even death. They are fighting because they believe in a cause. They hunger to fight. They want to be a part of their war effort. Since she was there, with Jagang, Nikki has first-hand knowledge. She has seen things that may help put it into perspective for you." Richard turned again to Nikki. She looked like a statue, her skin smooth and fair, her blonde hair tumbled down over her shoulders. There was nothing about her face, her figure, that Richard would have changed if he were the one to carve a statue of her. She was a picture of beauty, who had seen ugliness beyond imagining. "Nikki, please tell these men what will happen to them if they are captured by the Imperial Order." Richard had no idea what she would say, what she knew. But he did know, especially from the things Jebra had told them, that the Order had only contempt for life. "The Order does not execute their captives immediately." With deadly calm, Nikki glided one step closer to all the men staring at her. She waited at Richard's side until the silence was painful, and she had the undivided attention of every man before her. "First," she said, "every man captured is castrated." A collective gasp went up from the assembled men. "After that, after they have suffered unendurable agony and humiliation, the ones still alive are put to torture. The ones who survive the torture are finally put to death in one brutal fashion or another. Those who surrender to the Order without a fight are spared such treatment. That is the design behind the cruelty toward captives, to strike fear into a potential adversary so that they will surrender without a fight. Their treatment of civilians in captured cities is just as brutal, and it has the same goal in mind. As a result, many cities have fallen to the Order without a fight. You men have fought them long and hard. You would not be spared any of it. If you are caught by Jagang's forces, there is no hope for you. You will be made to wish with all your hearts that you had never been born. Death will be your only release. Not that it matters. Life under the Order is not much different than waiting for death at the hands of the Order. Life under the Order is a slow, grinding death in itself. It just takes longer. The misery of it stretches out over years. Only those who hate life, and everything good, prosper. The Order, in fact, fosters and encourages those who hate the good aspects of life. Their teachings are, after all, formed from a bitter hatred for the good. The environment such beliefs create is one of universal misery. The haters relish the misery of others, since the good angers them. If captured, these haters would be your masters." The men stood in stunned silence. In that silence, Richard heard the gentle patter of rain on the awning stretched overhead. The storm was rolling in on them. Nikki spoke offhandedly into the silence. "The fried testicles of their enemies are a prize treat for the soldiers of the Imperial Order. The camp followers will scour a battlefield after a battle, looking for loot and any wounded enemy still alive that they can castrate. Those precious bloody gems harvested from a living enemy are a valuable and sought-after commodity during the drunken celebration after a victory. The soldiers believe that such a delicacy gives them greater strength and virility. Afterwards, they turn their attention to the women captives. Richard pinched the bridge of his nose between a thumb and first finger.
Anything else?
Nicky raised an eyebrow.
Isn't that enough?
Richard heaved a sigh as he let his hand drop.
I guess so.
He turned back to the men. The simple truth is that there is no way you can win the coming battle. You are going to lose. Richard took a deep breath and finally uttered the unspeakable words he had come to say. That is why there will be no final battle. We will not fight Emperor Jagang and his army of the Imperial Order. As Lord Rawl, leader of the Daharan Empire, I refuse to allow such an act of pointless self-destruction. We will not fight them. Instead, I have come to disperse our army. There will be no final battle. Jagang will have the new world unopposed.
Richard saw tears filling the eyes of many a man.
Chapter 25. Richard's words were received like a slap. An angry officer shouted, "Then why should we fight?" He swept an arm around at his fellows. "We've been at this war for years. Many of our fellow soldiers are no longer here with us because they have sacrificed their lives to preserve our cause and loved ones. If there is no chance, if we are just going to lose in the end, then why have we bothered to fight? Why should we bother to continue in this struggle?"
Richard smiled bitterly.
"That's the whole point." "What point?" the man growled. "If people see no chance for triumph, no chance to win, and see instead that they face only ruin and death, then they will begin to lose their will to fight. If they see that they have no chance to spread their beliefs, that they face only death if they continue to try to do so, then they will begin to want to forget all about such a war."
If anything, the man was only getting angrier, as were many of the other officers.
"So you're telling us to forget about the war? That we can't win against the will of the Order? That since we can't win, there is nothing to fight for?"
Richard clasped his hands behind his back as he lifted his chin with resolve. He waited until he was sure that he had every ear.
"No. I'm telling you that I want to make the people of the old world feel that way."
The men frowned in confusion, muttering questions among themselves. They quickly quieted down as Richard went on.
"Jagang is bringing his army up into Dahara. He wants to meet us in battle. Why? Because he believes he can defeat us. I believe he is right. I don't believe this because you men lack anything in bravery, training, strength, or skill, but simply because I know how vast his resources are. I've spent time down in the old world. I know how vast the place is. To an extent, because I have traveled through the old world, I know how many people they have, how much livestock, crops, and other assets. I've seen these things on a scale I've never seen before. They have reserves you cannot even begin to imagine. Jagang has amassed an enormous force of savage men who are devoted to their beliefs. They intend to crush everyone and everything opposing them. They lust to be conquering heroes, to spread their faith. Jagang has been provided with everything his experience tells him he will need, and then he doubled it. Just to be certain, he then doubled it again. Jagang does not hold perverse moral notions of warfare fought by employing no more assets than an opponent possesses, of some kind of fabricated fairness imposed on the act of mortal combat. He has no interest in an equal contest, nor should he. He is interested only in mastering us. That is his task. To that end, they want us to defend from the position of our greatest vulnerability, fight from our weakest footing, on the battlefield, in a traditional final battle. That is what all of Jagang's efforts have been dedicated to because it's what everyone expects. They want to meet us this way because we don't stand a chance against their numbers. There is simply no way that we have enough forces to prevail. They will then crush us. Afterwards, they will celebrate their great victory, as if the accomplishment was ever in doubt, by frying up your testicles and then in a drunken orgy they will rape your wives and sisters and daughters."
Richard leaned toward the men and jabbed a finger at his temple.
"Think! Are you so mired in the concept of a traditional final battle that you have forgotten its purpose? Are you putting the way it's always been done ahead of the reason for doing it? The sole reason for such a battle is to prevail over the enemy, to settle the matter once and for all. That concept of a final battle has evolved into thinking that it's the way it must be done, because that is the way it always has been done. Stop being pointlessly tied to that idea. Think. Stop being blinded by what you have done before. Stop throwing yourselves into your graves as if by rote. Think. Think about how to accomplish our objective. You mean to say that you have a better idea than fighting them? A younger officer asked. Like most of the men, he looked truly puzzled. Richard took a breath in an effort to get a grip on his temper. He lowered his voice and looked among all the sober faces as he went on. Yes. Instead of doing the expected and throwing ourselves into a final battle, I simply want to destroy them. That is, after all, the root objective of a grand final battle. If such a battle will not accomplish that objective, then we must find another way. Unlike those who fight for the beliefs of the order, none of us needs to brag about a glorious victory on the field of battle. There is no glory in such things. There is simply success or failure. Failure means a new dark age. Success means we live free. Civilization hangs in the balance. It's as simple as that. There is no narrowly defined field of battle in such a struggle for life. Such a struggle for our very survival against men driven by a desire to murder us because they think we have no right to exist. Such a struggle is not a fight over a plot of ground, a war over turf, but is based in the minds of men, based in the very ideas that motivate them. Our loved ones will not be better served by a victory on a battlefield. They will only be served if we prevail in this struggle of ideas. General Myford finally lifted a hand to speak. Lord Rawl, if not by meeting them in combat, then how do you propose we accomplish such a task against a foe that you have just explained is so vast that it is unbeatable? After all, even if it is their beliefs that drive them, it is their swords that we must deal with. Men nodded, happy that their general had asked the question they all had in mind. It was also the question Richard had been waiting for. He had discouraged their hope of a victory in a traditional battle by throwing out their mindset. Now he had to show them how to win the war. As the drumbeat of rain on the tarp overhead increased, Richard, hands clasped behind his back, appraised all the faces watching him. You must be the thunder and lightning of freedom. You must be vengeance unleashed against a people with corrupt ideas that have not just allowed evil to dwell in their hearts, but authorized and advocated it. We must fight the war our way. We must fight it for what it really is. Not armies on a field of battle acting as surrogates for ideas, but as a war for the future of mankind. As such, it is a war in which the old world is totally committed, in which everyone on their side has dedicated themselves to the struggle. They are passionate about their cause. They believe in what they are doing. They think they have right on their side, that they are acting morally, that they are fulfilling the Creator's wishes, and so they are justified in murdering whoever they wish in order to define how mankind will live. They are all investing their property, their labor, their wealth, and their lives in the struggle. Their people, not just their army, want to subjugate us and make us bend to their beliefs. They want us to be slaves to their faith, just as they are. They encourage their army to attack innocent people here, in the New World, in order to force their beliefs on us. They want us, as followers of the same faith as they, to sacrifice our lives to that faith, to live the lives they wish us to live, to dictate what our children will believe, by force, if necessary. All the people who believe in the ways of the order, who contribute, who encourage, who support, who pray for their soldiers to crush us, are part of their war effort. Each of those people adds something to their cause. As such, they are just as much the enemy as the soldiers swinging the swords for them. They are the ones who feed their blades with a supply of young men, and everything they need to come after us, from food to moral support and encouragement. Richard pointed south. In fact, those people who make this war possible, are perhaps even more of an enemy because each one is a silent enabler who wishes us harm from afar, who hates by choice, who believes that there is no consequence for them forcing their will on us. Loot and plunder goes back to reward their support. Slaves are sent back to labor for them. Blood and tears are extracted to enforce their demands for faith. These people have made the choice to believe, made the choice to think that they have a right to our lives, made the choice to do anything necessary to rule us. There must be consequences to the choices they have made, especially when their choices ruin the lives of others who have done them no harm.
Richard opened his hands.
And how are we to accomplish this?
He drew his hands into fists.
We must bring this war home to the people who support and encourage it. It must not simply be the lives of our friends, our families, our loved ones, who are thrown into the bloody cauldron these people of the old world stoke. It must now be their lives as well. They see this as a struggle for the future of mankind. I intend to see that it is. I want them to fully understand that if they set out to murder and subjugate us, for whatever reason, then there will be consequences. From this day forward, we will fight a real war, a total war, a war without mercy. We will not impose pointless rules on ourselves about what is fair. Our only mandate is to win. That is the only way we, our loved ones, our freedom, will survive. Our victory is all that is moral. I want any supporter of the order to pay the price for their aggression. I want them to pay with their fortunes, their future, their very lives. The time has come to go after these people with nothing but cold black rage in our hearts.
Richard lifted a fist.
Crush their bones to blood and dust!
There was a moment of silence as everyone took a collective breath. And then a thunderous cheer erupted, as if they had all secretly known that they had no chance to succeed, and that they were doomed to face only death and failure in the end. But now they had been shown that there was a way. There was, at last, a real chance to save their homes and loved ones, to save the future. Richard let the revelry go on for a time, then held up a hand to make them listen as he went on.
The army of the Order has the support of the people of their homeland. The soldiers of the Order each know that their families, friends, and neighbors support them. The men of the Order need to hear from those back in the old world. What I want the men of the Order to hear are wails of agony. I want them to know that their homes are being gutted, their cities and towns leveled, their businesses and crops destroyed, and their loved ones left with nothing. The Order preaches that life in this world is nothing but misery. Make it so. Strip away the thin veneer of civilization they so despise.
Richard looked to Verna, and the women with her, Sisters of the Light, all.
They hate magic. Make them terrified of it. They think those with magic must be destroyed. Make them believe that they can't be. They want a world without magic. Make them wish only not to anger us ever again. They want to conquer. Make them want only to surrender.
As the lightning crackled through the gloomy afternoon air, and the wind-driven rain beat against the awning overhead, Richard turned his attention back to the men. When the latest crackle of thunder died out, he went on.
To accomplish our purpose, we must have a coordinated plan aimed at every facet of the threat. To this end, some of our forces must be devoted to the important goal of hunting and killing their supply trains. Those trains are essential to the Order's survival. They not only get the reinforcements they need, but those trains send a steady stream of supplies that they must have in order to survive. The Imperial Order forces plunder as they go, but it's nowhere near enough to sustain them. Their overwhelming size is also a vulnerability. We must deny them those supplies they need to survive here in such numbers. We must cut that vital link. If the Imperial Order's soldiers starve to death, they are just as dead. Any Order soldier who dies of starvation is one less we have to worry about. That's all that matters to us. Also, The recruits coming up from the south will be much more vulnerable since they will not yet have joined up with experienced men, or be in massive numbers. They are poorly trained, and little more than young thugs going off to rape and pillage. Slaughter them before they go north and have the chance. It will be ever more difficult to enlist new recruits if they are being killed on their own soil before they can ever go off to kill helpless strangers. Even better if they are small units just assembling in their hometowns. Bring the war to them. Kill them before they have a chance to bring it to us. If young men know that if they volunteer, they will never get to be heroes, never get their hands on plunder and young captive women, and see that they will not make it far before they are set upon by men who don't fight as they expected, don't throw themselves into a futile final battle against impossible odds, their passion for joining the fight will turn icy cold. If it doesn't, then they can die too, before they ever have a chance to join the army to the north. Seeing the bodies of these young heroes-to-be rotting on their doorsteps will help us crush the spirit of the people of the old world. Richard appraised the intent gazes before going on. The idea of a final battle dies here. Dies today. Today we dissolve into thin air. After today there will be no Daharan Empire army that the Imperial Order can engage in a final battle and destroy. They want to do this, after all, in order to strip our people of our protection, leaving them naked and vulnerable. We are not going to allow that. Today we start fighting this war a new way, our way, a way rationally thought out, a way that will win. I want everyone in the old world to fear you as if you were avenging spirits. Beginning today, you will become the Phantom Daharan Legions. No one will know where you are. No one will know when you will strike. No one will know where you will strike next. But I want everyone in the old world to know without any doubt whatsoever that you will come after them and you will strike as if the underworld itself were about to open up and annihilate them. I want them to fear the Phantom Daharan Legions as if you are death itself. They wish to die so that they may enter the everlasting glory of the afterlife. Deliver them their wish! One of the men toward the back cleared his throat, then spoke up. Lord Rawl, innocent people down there are going to die. These aren't soldiers we will be attacking. A lot of children are going to die in this kind of thing. Yes, that is unfortunately true. But don't let your mind be clouded or your determination turned aside by such a spurious and irrelevant charge. The Order is responsible for conducting a war of aggression against innocent people who have done them no harm, including women and children. We seek only to end the aggression as swiftly as possible. It's true that innocent people, including children, will be hurt or killed. What is the alternative? Continuing to sacrifice good people out of fear of harming someone innocent? We are all innocent. Our children are all innocent. They are being harmed now. The Order's rule will eventually harm everyone, including all those children in the old world. The Order will turn many of them into monsters. Many more people will die in the end if the Order wins. Moreover, the lives of the people in the old world are not our responsibility. They are the Order's responsibility. We did not start this war and attack them. They attacked us. Our only proper course of action is to end the war as swiftly as possible. This is the only way to do that. In the end, this is the most humane thing we can do, because in the end, this will mean the least loss of life. Whenever possible, you should, of course, avoid harming innocent people. But that is not your overriding objective. Ending the war is your objective. To do that, we must destroy their ability to wage war. As soldiers, that is the responsibility. We are defending our right to exist. If we succeed, we will, as a consequence, help countless others to live free as well. But it is not our aim to free their people. If they wish to be free, then they can join with us in our efforts. As a matter of fact, I know people in the old world who have already revolted against the Order and are with us in this struggle. A simple blacksmith named Victor and his forces in Alto Rang, for example, have lit the flame of freedom in the old world and already fight with us. Wherever you can find these people who hunger to be free, you should encourage them and enlist their support. They will willingly see their towns and cities burn if those blazes destroy the vermin who eat away at their lives. In all you do, never forget that your aim is to stop the Order from killing us, and to do that we must make them lose their will to fight. To do that, we must take the war to them. I grieve for innocent lives lost, but their loss is a direct result of the immoral actions of the Order. We have no responsibility to sacrifice our lives to prevent innocent people on their side being harmed. We cannot be responsible for their lives in such a struggle not of our making. We have every right to defend our right to exist. Don't let anyone ever tell you otherwise. The threat must be eliminated. Anything else is just whistling on your way to your grave.
The men all stood somber and still under the billowing awning protecting them from the downpour. None had any argument to offer. They had been fighting a losing battle for a long time. They had seen thousands die. They understood that there was now no other way.
Richard gestured to Captain Zimmer, a young, square-jawed, bull-necked man who stood with his arms folded across his massive chest. He was immersed in total concentration as he'd listened to Richard. The man had become the head of the Special Forces when Kalin had promoted Captain Myford to commanding general of the Daharan forces. Kalin had also told Richard that Captain Zimmer and his men were very good at what they did, that they were experienced, businesslike under stress, tireless, fearless, and coolly efficient at killing. What made most soldiers blanch made them grin. Kalin had also told him that they collected the ears of the enemy. Captain Zimmer, as part of our new coordinated operation, I have a special job for you. The man beamed with an infectious smile as he dropped his arms and stood up straighter. Yes, Lord Rawl? Of primary importance is the elimination of anyone, who preaches the tenets of the Order. These people are the fount of hate, the source of the corrupt beliefs that poison life. The Fellowship of Order has set their goal on the conquest of all of mankind for the purpose of bringing all people under their strict teachings. They advocate the killing of all those who don't bow to their beliefs. The ideas of these men are the spark that ignites murder. Were it not for those teachings, they would not be here killing people. The Order is a viper that exists because of their beliefs, their ideas, their teachings. That viper stretches here all the way from the heart of the old world. From this moment on, your objective is to behead this snake. Kill every man who preaches their beliefs. If they give a speech, the next morning I want their body found in the middle of a very public place, and I want it to be clear to all that they did not die of natural causes. I want it known that professing the beliefs of the Order is asking for a swift death. How you kill them is irrelevant, but kill them you must. When they are dead, they can no longer spread their poison and raise the passions of other men to kill us. That is your job. Kill them. The less time you take killing one, the sooner you can kill others. Keep in mind, though, that the high priests of the Fellowship of Order are gifted. While you must be cautious and aware that these men are wizards, also keep in mind that even such wizards still have hearts that pump blood through their veins. An arrow will kill them as surely as any other man. I know, because not long ago I was nearly killed by an arrow fired in a surprise attack on my camp. Richard gestured to the two women behind him. I was fortunate in that Kara and Nikki were there to save my life. The point is that, despite their power, these men are vulnerable. You can eliminate them. After all, how often have I heard you men say that you will be the steel against steel so that I can be the magic against magic? Implicit in that maxim is the fundamental truth that the gifted are mortal and vulnerable to the same perils as all men. I know that you and your men will find ways to eliminate these men. I want every man who preaches the hate of the Order's beliefs to find that death is the consequence. There must be no doubt of the hard truth that they are not going to escape that fate just because they are gifted. You and your men are to deliver that truth to them. This is, after all, about truth and illusion, a battle over which of those concepts mankind will serve. They preach an illusion of beliefs in things that are not real, of faith and fantasy, of kingdoms in other worlds, of punishments and rewards after we no longer exist. They kill to force people to bow to that faith. The counter to that is the reality of our promise of the consequence of harming us. That promise must be kept. That promise must be true. If we fail in this struggle, then mankind will slip into a long, dark age.
Richard looked out over the silent men and spoke quietly, but in a tone that every man heard. I am counting on the experience and judgment of you men to accomplish what we must. If you see something you think is useful to them, destroy it. If anyone tries to get in your way, kill them. I want their crops, homes, towns, and cities burned to the ground. I want to see the old world burning all the way from here. I don't want one brick left standing atop another. I want the old world to suffer such ruin that they no longer possess the ability to extend their murderous intent to others. I want their will to fight broken. I want their spirits crushed. I trust that you men will be able to come up with ways to accomplish all this. Don't be limited by what I tell you. Think about what is a valuable resource to them and what would make it a good target for us. Think of how best to carry out your new orders. He watched the eyes of men who were being called upon to do what they had never expected would be their job. There will be no final battle with the army of the Order. We will not face them in the way they wish. Instead, we will haunt them into their graves. The gathered officers all clapped fists to their hearts. Richard turned again to Captain Zimmer. You have my orders as to your specific objective. Be ruthless. There is to be no alternative allowed for these men. Their death is the only result that is acceptable. Make it swift, sure, and without mercy. Captain Zimmer stood tall. Thank you, Lord Rawl, for allowing me and my men to rid the world of those who preach this poison. There's one other thing I'd like you and your men to do for me. Yes, Lord Rawl? Bring me their ears. Captain Zimmer smiled as he put a fist to his heart. There will be no escape or mercy for them, Lord Rawl. I will bring you proof. As they put their minds to their new goal, the officers all began coming forward with suggestions for both targets and methods of destroying them. Their enthusiasm enlivened their faces, as if they had gotten so used to the idea that there was no choice but to be worn down by an implacable enemy, that their faces had taken on creases as they sagged with the burden. Now Richard could see a new vigor in them, an excitement that there was a solution, an end in sight. Men offered ideas of salting fields, poisoning water supplies with rotting, infected carcasses and corpses, destroying dams, cutting down orchards, slaughtering livestock, and torching mills. Nicky discouraged some suggestions, explaining why they wouldn't work or would involve too much effort, and offered alternatives in their place. She refined other ideas to make them more devastating. To a degree, Richard was sickened by the things he heard, and the knowledge that he was the architect of such mayhem. But then he thought about the vision Shota had given him of Kalin, of how those very horrors and more were real for uncounted innocent people. And he was gratified that they were at last striking back in a way that had a chance to end such horrors. The Order, after all, had brought this on themselves. Time is of the essence, Richard told the officers and gathered sisters. Every day that passes, the Order captures more places, subjugates, tortures, rapes, and murders yet more people. I agree, General Myford said. This can't be a march south.
This is the end of disc number 9. Please continue listening on disc number 10.